Welcome to the Persuasion World of Work podcast. This is the podcast for people who are curious about working life and what it tells us about ourselves. Your hosts are Susie Kenefick and Áine Maguire. We're executive coaches with an insatiable curiosity about the life that is lived at work. In this podcast, we reflect on what's happening in the world of work and what it means for everyone who works.
Our topic today is how to bring people with you. Not literally, of course, but how do we communicate our ideas effectively in the workplace and build consensus? So this is our mini version of how to win friends and influence people. So have you ever had a really clear vision or strategy that you felt would bring value to your workplace, but failed to get people on board with your idea? Getting buy-in from people to translate your idea into reality is critical to the success of any plan. You may on occasion even find yourself having to execute an idea or vision that isn't yours, but it's your job to bring people with you when it comes to implementing it. So Áine, when you think of influential leaders who have the skill to bring people with them, who springs to mind?
It's interesting because often you can think of the leaders who can't do it very well or have failed to do it very well. And I suppose that tells us something that maybe every success is in the moment. So sometimes you can be successful at bringing people with you and sometimes you just can't. But one of the things that I've been thinking about was the whole movement around the environment and people like Al Gore, David Attenborough, Bill Gates, people like that, who collectively over time, I think, have really started to bring people with them and have changed our attitudes and also our behavior in terms of the environment we live in and the practices that we have about preserving that and taking us away from jumping on planes and aerosols. So I think they're probably the leaders we've seen there are a very good example. Another good example closer to home for us would be John Hume, someone who I think had a very quiet authority and influenced in a way that I think had a great deal of integrity and also influenced through the power of his words and the power of his vision. And I think he's a good example because he probably wasn't the most glamorous person of all time and he wasn't in the most glamorous of circumstances, but I think his credibility came from his authenticity, something we've talked about a lot. So there's a few examples. And maybe another example from a different age and environment, Jacinda Ardern, her ability brought her people with her through the pandemic in New Zealand would be, I think, another very good example. Yeah. What about you? Any examples from you?
Yeah, I love Jacinda Ardern. I think she's a great leader. Really, really good. Any excuse to talk about her, I'll always take. But yeah, no, I agree. And I think, yeah, Bill Gates and David Attenborough, also very good examples. I mean, you know, I actually did my master's research on the sort of behavioral aspects of the environment and on sustainable behavior and looking at how we actually incentivize people to change their behavior. And it is very, very complex. And it is a really, really good example of how we have to almost en masse find a way to bring people with us and looking at exactly what that entails and how it's executed. I think that's definitely something we're going to delve into in a bit more detail today.
Yes, we have a very interesting guest who aligns very nicely with our topic. And our guest is Tim Long, who is a strategy consultant and is going to give us some of his ideas on the ways he works to bring people with him in his workplace and in his work. So more from Tim later. But let's start, Susie, by delving into this topic and hearing from you what the science tells us about how to bring people with us in the workplace in the Susie Talk slot.
Thank you. Well, when I was looking at some of the literature around this topic, I came across what I think is potentially a very useful definition to describe what we're talking about today. And that is the skill of tapping into the emotions that drive people's actions. So I think what we mean when we're talking about bringing people with us, it's not just about compelling people to behave in a certain way because they have to, i.e. because it's your job and you're paid to do it, but actually establishing an emotional connection or an impetus for people to behave in a certain way because they actually want to. So I think this is sometimes described in the workplace as getting buy-in, and that's obviously a critical component of how leaders get people in their workplaces to, you know, to come along with them and to help them to implement whatever their strategy or plan might be. And of course, a lot of this comes down to how we communicate. So it's very useful to look at what an influential communication style or the kind of style that will bring people with you and what that might entail. So I suppose in that regard, there's a really important distinction that I want to make between making people do something and making them want to do something.
So, okay, so yeah. Tell us, how do you make people want to do something?
Well, I'll firstly say, if you're interested in reading a little bit more about this, there's a great article in the Harvard Business Review, which I'll link in the show notes, that looks at strengthening your ability to influence people. It's by Ben Laker and Sharmi Patel. I know we actually reference the HBR quite regularly, and I suppose I should just note that it's a subscription service. I think you get a certain number of free articles per month if you don't sign up to it, but it's not very expensive. It's about, I think I pay about €12 a month. And I think for anybody working in leadership or working in an organization who's interested in these kinds of topics, it's actually well worth investing in, because the articles they have are very, they're not overly scientific. They're very, very digestible. So
there's a good blend of digestible and then a few more scientific ones. We must talk to HBR about sponsoring our podcast now that we've given them this lovely plug.
Maybe. So Ben Laker and Sharmi Patel, they outline the distinction between transactional communication and transformational communication. And the latter, it's fair to say, is often what is associated with these very charismatic leaders that we've been talking about. So a transactional communication style focuses on actionable transactions between a leader and their team. So there is a very strong element of hierarchy here. Effectively, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. I'm asking you to do something because I'm your boss and I pay you. So it works to motivate people on a short-term basis, but it does tend to be less relational.
Okay, so the deal is you turn up, you do X, Y, and Z, I pay you, end of transaction.
Exactly.
Right. Now,
on the other side of the coin, a transformational communication style is where the communicator offers a vision or some excitement, encouragement, or all kinds of possibilities to their audience. So what they're seeking to do there is to connect with the audience, possibly on an emotional level, sometimes offering the way to a promised land where things will look better. Mm. Now, this style can be quite light on detail in terms of exactly what the future to be realized looks like, or how exactly we can get there. But it's very effective at motivating people and uniting them around a common solution.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be a bit scary, though, because my experience is there isn't usually a promised land to go to. And often people who promise a promised land end up taking you to somewhere that's really quite unpleasant.
I think so. And I think there is a conflict that we have to acknowledge here, because I think as long as the workplace in its current guise has existed, probably it's the more transactional kind of leadership that has been used to get the results that people want. It's this idea of hierarchy. I'm your leader, I'm your manager, I'm telling you what you need to do. And if you don't do it, well, you're not going to get your bonus, or you're not going to get a good review, or you're not going to get a pay rise, all of these things. They do engage people on a short-term basis, you know, toward achieving a particular tangible goal. And oftentimes, as you say, I think that goal is very tangible. So I think the transactional leadership style is sometimes easier for people to understand, but ultimately it's not really effective at getting people to buy in on a really, really deep level to whatever the vision or the strategy of the organization is.
Okay. Do you have a sense of which would be most effective if somebody was listening to this podcast and thought, I've got something, you know, in my work agenda that I really want to work on bringing people that I work with me? What sort of style would you suggest?
Well, I mean, being the sort of person I am, of course, I would absolutely always opt for the transformational leadership style, that one that is relational. It's not based on hierarchy. It's about motivating people on an emotional level and to bring them with you, because I think ultimately in the long term, that is the strategy that's going to work best if you want to bring people with you. But I think another place probably where there is that little bit of tension between, you know, the short-term objectives of a workplace or an organization in terms of whatever their financial targets might be, you know, are they willing to maybe spend a bit of time investing in this kind of leadership style so that they reap the benefits of it perhaps further down the line than they would like? Or are they going to stick to that more transactional style to just kind of get through their targets on a day-to-day basis and whatever their, you know, different KPIs might be? So that's my view, and I don't know what you think.
Well, it sounds to me listening to you that what most leaders of organizations probably have is a hybrid style, a bit of both. You know, there's some transactional stuff, and then there's also, there needs to be a long-term agenda. And that's typically what you'll see with senior managers and leaders in an organization. There are things that need to be done, you know, quickly and every day. And there are also things that need to be done over the longer term, which is obviously why we're going to be talking about strategy later on, because that's ultimately what proves an organization's success. So maybe, would you think it'd be fair to say that most good leaders can fluently flip between both transactional and transformational styles?
I think they should be able to. And I also think that it comes down to maybe the people that you're dealing with. Some people will respond better to a more directive, or, you know, I hasten to say dictatorial leadership style, because that's just how they're used to being motivated. Whereas other people need something a lot deeper and something that really kind of taps into their intrinsic motivation and what they're all about and their strengths as an employee. So yeah, hybrid style, I think, is probably the most effective.
What you just said there makes me think that you've landed on something really important, which is that all leadership is situational. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in a burning building and I'm the chief exec of, you know, a business of 300 people, I'm not going to say, what do people think about leaving the building now? I'm going to issue a direct instruction, leave the building now. And that's the appropriate thing to do in light of my responsibilities. Whereas if I want people to, you know, stop wasting money by, you know, unnecessarily printing things on paper, I might need to persuade them a bit more and appeal to their better instincts. And it might take me longer, and a more transformational style might work there. Would you agree?
I think that's probably right. Yeah. I mean, we talk about this sometimes as well as the downside of emotional intelligence. If you are a leader who has a lot of that, sometimes you can get overly kind of, you know, mired in the complexities of people's potential emotional responses to something that you're planning on doing, and possibly lose sight of the task at hand that just needs to progress in a certain way. And sometimes you need to be a little bit more transactional, I think, in those circumstances, just to be more task oriented and to actually keep moving. You know, we can't be too concerned about people's responses, you know, on a day-to-day basis, probably. Might be one way of looking at it. Yeah.
Very good.
Okay. So I suppose just a few other kind of key elements of a transformational communication or leadership style that I wanted to mention. And I know I've already mentioned Jacinda Ardern because I love her, but I wanted to mention an article that I read in The Guardian recently about the New Zealand COVID response strategy. It's sort of a case study, which I'll link it in the show notes as well. It's an interesting article just about the success of New Zealand strategy, you know, on this and the different elements of that and how it all worked to come together. But, you know, a couple of things I took from that. One was very much the positive slant. They tried to motivate people here by encouragement and by really focusing and emphasizing what the positive consequences of doing the desired behavior would be. And I think that's something that I saw in that research I did myself on behavioral change in the environmental sphere. It's about focusing on what actually are, you know, what are the benefits for people? Why am I doing this? And it's the carrot or stick argument, you know, that old question, which is better? And I think absolutely by far, it's the carrot. We have to focus on why we're doing something and how it benefits us, because that is much more powerful and compelling in terms of motivating people than telling them what the negative consequences are going to be if they don't do what they need to do. So, you know, that's one side of it. And also having a very clear organizing principle. So in New Zealand, they had this slogan and it was called Unite Against COVID-19. And they had a dedicated, trustworthy source of information as well, where people could go and find all the information that they needed. So it was very coherent as a strategy. And that's something that was underlined in this article as well. You know, the importance of trust, the trust that the people had in the government. So that was important. And so was the sense of autonomy and direction, I think, is something, you know, that needs to be shared by everybody on a team. And again, that's talking about, you know, a less hierarchical leadership structure where everybody feels like their voice matters and everybody feels like they are part of executing whatever the strategy is. So that's really critical. And that just comes down to understanding human behavior, which I think is possibly something that is more topical now in workplaces than it was previously. And that also feeds into what I was saying about understanding the difference between the carrot and stick argument. You know, we have to focus on the positives. So I suppose then just one or two other points to summarize from the rest of the research that I did on this, but I think clear language is really important. So we're talking about communication. And there's a good TED talk that I'm going to reference in the show notes as well called Lost in Translation, which just talks about the prevalence of the use of jargon in modern organizations and how actually that can be incredibly alienating for people and very disengaging. So whatever communication strategy you're using, it has to be very clear in order to be effective. So that's something to bear in mind. And then lastly as well, I think strong leadership. I mean, that's something we've referred to already. Mm. And obviously Jacinda Ardern is a good example, but there are myriad examples, and as you mentioned, a few of them earlier in the podcast. So any thoughts?
Yeah, loads of thoughts. You know me, I love my tips. Yeah, I do. I mean, I think you've nailed it there. One tip that I have is that when you are trying to communicate something to somebody or to people, try to be in their world, not yours. Because something I noticed is we try to communicate things in the way that we think rather than the way that people are trying to communicate to think. Mm. So what matters to your target audience? How do they communicate? And also, most importantly, what do you want them to do? Because, you know, they might be able to adopt your ideas, but it's the actions that really reinforce the leadership that you have. So what actions do people take as a result of listening to you is what's very important. I'd also say, probably reflecting a little bit of what you say, focus on the upsides, the positive communications, like stay at home, save lives, what you're doing as a result of this, or what positive thing we're going to get. A call to action, I think, is very important in any communication. So even if you remember the childhood slogan, an apple a day keeps the doctor away or the dentist away, you know, that's a nice example of, you know, something you can do and the positive benefits. So call to action, very important. I think when you're communicating something complex, or when you are trying to shift attitudes or behavior over time, which most leaders are, you need to think of this as a long game rather than a task. So you do your work over time, and the way that people's attitudes to the environment and people's behavior in the environment has changed is a very good example. That's taken 20 years. So leadership is a complex job. It takes a long time to get buy-in from people, and it's something you have to do all the time. You have to be quite strategic about it. So I think also be careful to manage your credibility. As we've identified, overly charismatic communication and overly positive leaders tend to get found out. So manage the message, manage expectations, but also take it in bite sizes. Influencers play a long game. They win people over gradually. There are my tips.
They're very interesting. And I was thinking as you were talking, because of your background in marketing, this is probably something that you have a lot of insights on. And you mentioned there about tailored communication and knowing your audience. And that's all really important. But, you know, that article that I mentioned talked about the New Zealand COVID strategy. They actually talked an awful lot about the marketing around the strategy and maybe comparing it to some other marketing campaigns in other countries where perhaps the message was different. And even right down to like what colours would look good on the posters and the leaflets and how that appeals to the human behavior and all the psychology around that. So, I mean, that's something that we always have to be thinking about, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I think you've brought something very important to the conversation here, which is visual literacy. Mm. Because, of course, most people read things and interpret things visually. You know, it's a learning style, but it's probably the first thing you do with a public communication or a public communication like the COVID stuff or something you might see in a workplace. So for somebody like me who's in and out of workplaces all the time, I can tell a lot, and I often look at the posters that are on the factory floor or the employee notice in the toilet or whatever it is. You know, they're forms of communication. And I often think that maybe an integrated communication strategy across the whole employee experience might be a very useful way to think about how you bring your staff with you. You know, from the notice you have in the toilet telling people to not leave the floor dirty to the targets that you've put on the factory floor that people are supposed to be achieving.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you for that. Now we're moving on to our next segment, which is our interview.
Yes, looking forward to hearing what Tim has to say about how to bring people with you.
And now for our Persuasion World of Work career investigation, I would like to introduce our guest, Tim Long. As an experienced strategy consultant, effective communication and bringing people with him is an intrinsic part of Tim's role. After getting his MBS from Smurfit Business School in Dublin, Tim started his career in London, working for the leading consultancy, Simon Kucher & Partners. He returned to Ireland in 2013, where he joined PwC, before taking up his current role as Head of Retail Development Strategy at a major financial institution. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, Tim, you're very welcome. It's lovely to have you here. Let's just start off by asking you a really basic question. What on earth does a strategy consultant do?
So typically, a strategy consultant helps organizations make complex decisions and solve complex problems by objectively applying structured thinking, applying analysis, science, and rigor to the problem, and then aligning a group around whatever that answer is. We need strategy consultants really to come in and challenge the assumptions, but also understand how all the parts fit together. Because quite often you'll find organizations are so complex that there isn't a great understanding across businesses of that. So from that, they're unable to solve some complex problems.
So what attracts you to the world of strategy, Tim?
So Ani, I think there's a few things that really excite me about this work. Firstly, it satisfies my curiosity. So I get to work across a number of different industries. I get to work across different problems. So whether it's turnarounds of different businesses, mergers, growth strategies, you get to look at all sorts of opportunities as well. So it's very interesting, and you get to problem solve also. So you help facilitate the organizations in solving the issues in front of them. So that to me is hugely satisfying. Okay. But really what all of this is based on is building relationships where you can get greater understanding of the business, but also bring people with you on the journey. And really the foundation to all of that for me is building trust with the various stakeholders within it. So I just get a lot of personal satisfaction from working with almost a different set of people, depending on the project I'm on, and building the relationships with them.
Yeah. So it sounds like if we were to sort of follow you around with, a camera recording what you do on a day-to-day level, it would be about connecting with people and learning about what they're doing and bringing some learning and some new insights. Is that right? Would it be, relationship building, talking, listening, asking questions?
Yeah, I think that's the bedrock of it all. So if there's one word to take away from this, it's trust. So trust is the foundation of all relationships. I think a really important thing here to think about where we're bringing people with us is that if trust is really important, we can't assume trust, right? So in Ireland, we're all quite good natured and, we see the best in one another usually, but we can't assume trust, right? So we need to recognize that trust is built through lots of individual actions and behaviors. If I had one message for your listeners, it would be to consider every day, what will I do to build trust with my colleagues, with my friends, with my family, right? And none of this is new thinking. It's common sense. I know in Aristotle's Rhetoric, he suggests that the ethos or ethics of a man is based on their goodwill, their character, their intelligence, right? And that's a really useful way to think about building trust and bringing people with you, right? So in modern language, we think of that as a framework of competence, integrity, and benevolence, right? So competence, quite simply, is can you do the job? Do you have the expertise or the track record? Benevolence is important. It's what are your intentions? Are they good intentions? Do they align with mine? And then your integrity is just demonstrating the honesty and reliability. So have you kept your word? So if I was running a project in terms of, say, benevolence, you would start with setting out what the shared objective is. Why are we all together in this room? What's the thing we're trying to achieve? And being really clear when we're doing that, is this a directive or is it a collaborative effort? Because you need to be clear whether you're telling someone they're doing something or whether we're working together to resolve it.
I'm just wondering, you mentioned Aristotle there, and I do love a discussion on ancient philosophy. I'm just wondering, are there more modern examples, perhaps, of people who you admire, who maybe you think do this really well in terms of the execution of their leadership and bringing people with them?
There's probably two names spring to mind. One in particular, I think Tony Holohan demonstrates all the elements of building trust that I've mentioned and bringing people with him. In terms of benevolence, we have a clear understanding of his intentions. His intentions are good, okay? So he's trying to prevent people getting sick and trying to prevent, hospitals being totally overrun. He's also quite good at explaining what it means for me. What's the risk to me, so of getting sick or passing away? And then also in terms of action. So if you think about it, there's very understandable use cases for each person. So wash your hands, wear your mask, social distance, right? That's all very understandable. Also then in terms of that other element of building trust, competence, right? So everything's based on fact and science. Have we ever in Ireland seen so many charts and graphs? I don't think so. It's we're overwhelmed with them. We're swimming in them. And he delivers it all through a calm and steady tone. The way people connect with it is the integrity point. So he's done this while going through very tough personal circumstances. And people recognize then there's shared sacrifice. I must say I have huge admiration for how he's gone about doing this.
So who else? You mentioned two.
Another person I really like to highlight is Joanne Hessian, who's the founder of Lift Ireland. It's a not-for-profit organization that encourages better leadership in Ireland. They organize roundtables where people come together to discuss shared values. For me, she's another great example of a great communicator.
A lot of this, of course, is about communication, and we've touched a lot on what kinds of communication styles are required to bring people with us. But I mean, in your view and from your experience, is there a universally effective way to communicate, or do we need to tailor how we communicate to the audience?
I think that's a tough one. I think it's a broad topic because you could debate what we mean by communication and effectiveness. For me, and this might be a little esoteric, but I think there's probably one thing that helps me decipher it a little. I think often we treat communications as almost like a task or an afterthought. So if you think about it, if you're in work and you complete a big piece of work or a task, in order to get it to people, you may just email it. Or it just gets sent, right? And we don't put in the care and thought into how the message is received. So what we need to start doing is to just doing a very simple split of each little task we're doing in terms of how we think about it. So what is the task and how am I going to convey it and talk about it and think about it? So really simple things, really practical things. So should it be in writing? Should it be an email? Is it better in this instance to, you know, look a person in the eye, shake their hand when we're allowed to? If the message is sharing information, if you're asking questions or you're giving instructions, should these be delivered in different ways? I'm a big believer that if we're being conscious about these minor communications and how we deliver them, then we'll bring better awareness overall to how we're communicating. To me, that goes back to the key thing of it'll help build trust, right? Because mm-hmm. you're showing care and consideration to the other party who's involved.
I'm just curious about your working experience at the moment, probably like all of us, is something different to what you used to have. Have you altered your habits and your practices of, you know, building trust with people you work with because you're doing it virtually at the moment?
I think we have changed our practices. Previously, my preference would always be to get in a room with someone, look them in the eye, let them tell you the real story, let them vent about whatever we're working on or whatever the issue at hand is. But we're without that now. So we've almost moved from having very warm interactions, you know, being in a very expansive place to everything being reduced to communications coming through like a single cold wire. In order to build trust in that, you have to be really conscious about it. Again, it comes back to lots of boring, practical things. You got to prepare and know and be competent about it inside out. You got to be clear about the intentions of the work and understanding how it lines up with people and their work, I should say. And you got to deliver. If you say you're going to do something, you got to do it, right? Added to that, in terms of practical things, it's about booking in time to talk to people one-to-one, not in a formalized kind of session to go through everything in detail, but try to let people speak more openly and give them that space to speak.
We always ask people this. When you were a little boy, were you saying, "Mommy, I want to be a strategy consultant when I grow up"? What sort of things do you want to be?
I definitely wasn't saying I want to be a strategy consultant back then. I think some of the things that jumped out to me when I was a kid was like, I loved anything about space and astronomy. So I always liked the idea of being an astronaut. I thought that was so cool.
Wow, that's cool.
Because it was like the excitement of the adventure of it. Mm. I think also, I've spoken about curiosity already. Like, it's totally something to satisfy curiosity. Mm. And it seems to involve, again, problem solving. For me, it's important to be part of a team. So you'd be part of a well-functioning team. As someone who grew up in a house with six kids and two parents and a dog, well able to be in a well-functioning team in a confined space, right? And I've got some dispute resolution skills as well. So I think I could be useful in that setting. So if NASA are listening, I'm very open to that.
It's interesting because I'm sort of thinking to myself that you've gone from wanting to be an astronaut to actually being a sort of astronaut in the world of work, really, you know, dealing with black holes and ambiguity about what's our strategy, what are the issues here. You know, the team piece, I think, is really good because the skills you bring from your family background, and we see this all the time with people we interview on the podcast, what they learned, you know, at the kitchen table often gets expressed in their world of work. So do you see yourself as a sort of astronaut out there in the world of work?
Yeah, so I think the point you're making is really, really good, actually. So we're all increasingly in specialized roles. Think about what that means. We're in this little box and we don't know what's outside of the box. You do need people to go across those different boxes, you know, go from world to world and bring knowledge or help to solve problems, right? I don't think all of us put in enough time to sit back and just think of the context in which our job sits.
So, Tim, I think you make a really interesting point there. And I like what you did in terms of breaking down a job into its constituent elements so that it's about skills and strengths that you might bring to the table as opposed to exactly what it is technically that you're doing. And I know you made the point about people being increasingly very specialist. And, you know, you touched on the fact that like dispute resolution, being part of a team, being in a confined space or a stressful atmosphere, I suppose just in those terms, when we look at the strengths and the skills, what else do you think makes somebody particularly good at your job? For for say somebody who was maybe thinking about getting into the field?
Sometimes the language is loaded. So what is strategy, right? So let's just remove the mystique from some of these words. Strategy is just about plans based on the best information you have. That's what it is. So what's my plan to do something or resolve an issue? The kind of qualities or characteristics you might need, or you want to be curious and interested in solving almost puzzles. So how do things work? Am I interested in how things come together? How does this piece of the puzzle fit into the wider part? So I think that's really important. I would say being organized and resilient. If you're going into different fields, you're going to get a bit of pushback and you won't know everything immediately. So you need to be resilient to kind of understand how to respond to low information situations, to kind of challenging stakeholders, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, that probably leads to another one, which is how good your interpersonal skills are. So really, in all of this, it's about putting yourself in the shoes of the client, right? And for the various stakeholders as well that you're engaging with.
How did you get from that little boy that wanted to be an astronaut into somebody who's a real strategy consultant? Give us the kind of three or five steps that you needed to take from one to the other.
I would say some of it was luck, to be honest. Mm. My master's in UCD, you had a choice of either undertaking a thesis or delivering a project for a client. Mm. And I thought, that sounded very exciting, you know, a little different. And I said, I'd give it a go. And actually what I was doing in that work was there was an advisory firm and they were preparing for like the impending regulation of their industry. The work I was delivering for them was to understand the implications of the regulation if it came in and also, you know, how they could prepare for it, either potentially to no longer be in that market, to take advantage of that change or to see what they would do. I really, really loved that because I love the client interaction. I love the idea that you're helping someone to solve this puzzle and they haven't been able to get there themselves. After there, I moved to London and worked with a few different consultancies and it's been terrific. I'm back working for a financial institution in Ireland now as head of strategy. So it's a terrific field to go in. I would recommend people even do 6 months or a year of it because it gives you a perspective to look at organizations quite differently. So from you're able to zoom out and then zoom into particular problems.
Can I ask about the shoes off version of Tim? So when you close the laptop at the end of the day, are you still strategizing in your personal life? I mean, how big a part of your way of thinking is strategy? What are your hobbies? Are you a poker player?
If you're asking if I play Dungeons and Dragons, I don't. I think in a way, my hobbies do reflect some of those interests, right? As soon as I'm not working, I find I'm reading papers, reading books, watching history documentaries, loving to travel, traveling alone, traveling with friends, you know, going to different cultures and different countries and just experiencing different things. So I love that variety and just taking in all the information. I think there's something about, and I know another podcaster who's with us now likes to sea swim also. What I would say is I do think the sea swimming is powerful because it can change your perspective really quickly, right? You may be having one day, but once you get in the sea, you come out, you're having a very different day. I actually don't think it's a million miles away from some of the things that happen at work because really, what's happening is you're creating spaces where you have time to reflect and to change the way you think. So yeah, I do think some of my interests do reflect those kinds of things I pursue in work as well.
Is being a strategy consultant your calling or your vocation, or is it still an astronaut?
Well, I haven't given up hope on getting into space. You know, it's going to happen. But in the meantime, vocation to me, I immediately think of, you know, I have to don a habit and live in a convent or something like that. That's my idea of vocation. But really, I know what you mean with vocation. It's, you know, do you have a real interest, enthusiasm for it and a kind of a personal passion? I think I do I really do, as you can see by the kind of personal kind of hobbies I have. As I've said a few times, the problem solving, satisfying my curiosity, working with different types of people and working in a team. Yeah, so that aspect is definitely a vocation.
We can push the vocation question a little bit further. And this is the miracle question that we ask everybody at the end of the interview. But if I was to offer you a life-changing sum of money, which meant that you would never have to work again. Would you still be a strategy consultant?
I think I would. I could see myself stopping a particular project if it didn't interest me. But I think the pursuit and the activities, I would certainly continue. And I think I need to continue. It's an outlet for me as well. So,
Tim, thank you so much for giving us your time this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Lovely talking with you.
And that's all we have for you today, folks. See you again.